You're listening to Midori House, which was first broadcast on the 27th of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Ted Kravitz. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as Hurricane Isaac threatens to disrupt his party's convention, Mitt Romney accuses the Democrats of punching below the belt by making political capital out of the Todd Akin fallout. We've the latest from Washington, D.C. Our design editor Hugo McDonald previews the Architecture Biennale in Venice that opens its doors this week and its rather direct methods for engaging the public.
There's been a real effort to push it out into Venice. So I've actually taken over all the kiosks in the city and are using that to hand out flyers with various provocative slogans to engage not just the architecture industry, but people who want to stop off and buy some water and things, with questions to make them think about public space.
From the Mediterranean to the Baltic, cold winters, high taxes, and fish for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But we examine why the Nordic model of living is actually the best in the world. Plus, it's the schism that's torn Ohio's Amish community apart. 16 members of a breakaway group stand trial accused of cutting the beards of their fellow Amish. We also get a preview of what's going on in Brazil's mayoral elections and what passes for a party political broadcast there. Caro amigo eleitor, é a terceira vez que estou pedindo seu voto. Amigo, é bom imaginar. All that plus some toe-tapping music too. Coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, time to catch up on the latest world headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Around 2,000 workers, some carrying sticks and whips, have gathered today to protest near a hill where police shot dead striking platinum miners early this month. 44 people were killed on the 16th of August in union violence around Marikana. Miner Tebe Shashanke said he joined the protest as he needed a pay rise in order to be able to provide for his family.
Actually, I'm not afraid because of I'm fighting for what will make my life better, the money that it will help my family to live better. Because of now, actually, I'm a breadwinner at home. The money that I'm earning, it's a small money that cannot help my family. But I think 12,500 that we are fighting for, it will help our family, and then it will make our life easy.
Staying with mining news, and politicians have drowned out the Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh today as he sought to defend his government's role in an affair dubbed Coalgate, which is an acronym for a report published on the 17th of August that questioned the government's practice of awarding coal mining concessions to companies without competitive bidding, potentially costing the Treasury billions of dollars in lost revenues. As Tropical Storm Isaac churns over the Gulf of Mexico, delaying the start of the Republican National Convention by a day, workers are making finishing touches to the convention floor. Republican lawmakers, including Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson from Texas, remain confident their convention would be successful.
Obviously, there is an overlay of concern for the people who are being hit, but we're going to just make the best of it like Americans do. I mean, you take what is given to you and you roll with it. And the importance of the election and setting the stage for that is what we'll be focused on, and trying to make sure that America knows that there is a different way that can work. And more debt, more regulations, and more taxes is not the answer.
Activists from the international environmental organization Greenpeace have today chained themselves to a ship near Russia's Gazprom oil rig in the Arctic. The activists, including the organization's international executive director Kumi Naido, chained their motorboat to the ship's anchor.
This is a peaceful attempt by us as Greenpeace to try to bring some sanity, some urgency to get Gazprom and Shell and other companies that are thinking about drilling in the Arctic to stop, to reconsider and understand the consequences of that action that will destroy our children and grandchildren's future, which is what is at stake here.
Firefighters, soldiers and volunteers are battling to contain flames as a heat wave has broken temperature records today and set off wildfires across Kosovo. Worst affected is the Dragash region in southern Kosovo, where flames have gutted over 500 hectares of pine trees close to the border with Albania. In certain places, flames of 8 meters high have been witnessed. Staying with the weather news, and the extreme drought in the United States has had one positive effect for Indiana's hard-working police force. They're finding it easier to spot illegal marijuana growing operations in the south of the state. The browning forests and cornfields are uncovering marijuana sites, with 100 cannabis plants already cut down by the police there. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And Jonathan will be back with news headlines in about 25 minutes' time. It's 1.05 a.m. in Kuala Lumpur, 18.05 here in London, and 10.05 in Los Angeles, California. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London から Monocle 24 です。
Londonista käsin, tämä on Monocle 24.
London Bowl, as a Monocle 24.
Londonan, burası Monocle 24.
Londonist, siinä on Monocle 24.
London から, London より, Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House. Now, they say the best form of defence is attack. And that's a maxim Republican Party presidential candidate Mitt Romney is certainly taking to heart. Faced with a recent political gale, at least equal to whatever the approaching Hurricane Isaac has up its sleeve, Romney's gone on the offensive, possibly literally, some would say, claiming that the Democrats are engaging in a low form of politics by continuing to exploit the comments on rape and abortion made recently by Republican Missouri Senate candidate Todd Akin. Well, to discuss whether Romney's on the right track with this and how it's being received, Sasha Eisenberg joins us from Washington. He's Monocle's Washington correspondent, of course. Hi, Sasha. Now tell us, with Isaac on its way, how is Romney's let's hit them before they continue to hit us policy going down?
This has been a sort of gradual sort of acceleration of Romney's like willingness to call out Obama for being a bad guy. I mean, there was a sort of posture that Romney had throughout the primary season where he would say, Obama's a good man, but he's in over his head. He's not up to the job. And this was something that sort of, you know, came out of, I think, two things. One is the fact that Romney didn't have any like real personal animus towards Obama. They don't know each other at all. And the other part of it was that Republican strategists were very spooked by the fact that Obama is personally popular, even among people who aren't necessarily happy with the job he's been doing and are open to voting against him. And so they had an idea that they couldn't personalize their sort of disagreements with him. What's happened in the last few months is that Romney has seemed to develop a sort of personal dislike for Obama. And I think Republicans have come around to the idea that they really need to do something to bring down Obama's personal popularity. And part of that is sort of accusing him of playing a low form of politics, but being sort of cheap and exploitative and running dirty. And that's sort of become the new line out of Romney.
Indeed, but Todd Akin's comments were pretty much an open goal for the Democrats. Surely with the Republicans who tried to get him to withdraw, he didn't. Surely their best tactic would just be to run as far away from that and just not refer to it, rather than just referring any Democratic exploitation of it as a low form of politics.
Well, I mean, they have done what they can to run away from it, but with Akin saying that he's going to stay in the race, he is in, it's one of the most targeted states in the Senate races in the country. It's a state that Romney is counting on winning, that is sort of on the edge of the battleground map. So it's hard for them to ignore Missouri entirely. They can't pretend it doesn't exist. And the other part of it is that the Democrats aren't just making this about Todd Akin or his particular comments, but want to make it into a sort of broader sort of insertion of social politics and abortion and reproductive issues into the race, especially to sort of peel off Republican women, professional women who might be disappointed in Obama's term, but they want to make the case should feel sort of out of place in the modern Republican primary, modern Republican Party. And that's a harder thing just for Republicans to sort of walk away from, because the fact is that even if Mitt Romney doesn't, you know, agree with Todd Akin's sort of description of, like, you know, biology, they do broadly share a view on abortion policy, and that's the issue that Democrats want to make this, not just about Akin himself.
No, indeed. Okay. Well, tell us what's the scene in Tampa at the moment? What's been going on in the last day or so, and what's the program over the next few days?
Well, the initial plans for a 4-day convention basically got drawn down into 3 days because of the fear of the tropical storm Isaac arriving. It now seems as though it's taking a western course towards New Orleans. I believe just in the last hour called off the tropical storm warning for Tampa, but Republicans have already cleared the schedule today. So you have media, a very small number of protesters and sort of convention delegates who don't have any official business to attend to in the convention hall, but are sort of getting a slow start on things. And then tomorrow, the convention will kick into sort of full gear with the nighttime programming, and you know, network television will take all 3 nights of that, culminating in Romney's speech on Thursday night to formally accept the nomination.
Okay, and what are we expecting from that speech?
I think we're expecting Romney to sort of reveal himself more personally. He's always been a sort of guarded public figure, in part because, you know, he's wary of talking about his faith because of fear that Mormonism doesn't go over well, and he's been really cagey about talking about his business experience because Bain has become such a sort of toxic issue, and his wealth has become a sort of favorite topic for the Obama campaign. And, you know, the talk this week is that you know, Romney's sort of going to go out to reintroduce himself personally because the campaign realizes that they need to make him far more likable than he's been. He's one of the least popular nominees in history at this point, and there's a sort of understanding in the Romney campaign that he probably can't win the election if the majority of voters just personally don't like him or think that he's looking out for somebody other than them.
Yeah, it's an interesting job he has to do there, make himself a little more likable, or maybe explain the elements to his character that people yet don't quite understand. Any inkling amongst you and your fellow journalists there about how he might seek to do that?
Well, he wrote a sort of interesting essay in the Wall Street Journal on Friday. It was headlined, "What I Learned at Bain." And it was sort of the first time in the context of this campaign that instead of just saying I was really successful in business, you should put me into the presidency because I just trust me, it said, hey, I've learned specific lessons about trade policy, about economic change, about job creation. And I think that's sort of one of the big themes. You know, the Obama campaign has had great success in suggesting that Mitt Romney has not just become wealthy and successful, but has done it at the expense of middle-class people. And I think Romney wants to show that his business success was something that sort of, you know, lifted all boats by creating companies and jobs. And I think that's the story he's going to want to tell.
Indeed. And just finally, Sasha, this is time for Paul Ryan, his running mate, to step up as well.
Right. Wednesday, Ryan will give his speech accepting the vice presidential nomination. You know, Ryan is still not that well-known a figure. You know, as a member of Congress, represents only 600,000 people. This will be a sort of introduction, and it is a little different than other ones because there's such a sort of a real ideological, he arguably has a more formed ideological worldview than Romney does, which is a sort of peculiar circumstance for a running mate. So I think that there'll be some need both to tell people who he is personally, but also try to sort of contextualize his intellectual tradition to make sense of why he believes what he does about the budget.
Okay, so to sum up, Ryan is going to be explaining to the American people who he is. Romney is going to be explaining to the American people why they should like him if they don't already. What will Obama and the Democrats be doing all this time?
During this time, they'll be reminding people why they shouldn't trust Mitt Romney. I mean, it's been the sort of governing theme for the last year among Democrats, and still they think that their best guaranteed path to re-election is making Romney an unacceptable alternative. And so, you know, in this week and next week in Charlotte, the Democrat convention, I think they'll be trying to tell an upbeat version of the story of the last 4 years, but I think sprinkled through it is the idea that Barack Obama is on your side. Even if you haven't been crazy about the results so far, Mitt Romney definitely isn't and will never be.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, we'll see how that goes, and I'm sure we'll be in touch as the convention plays out this week. Thanks very much, Sasha. That's Sasha Eisenberg, Monocle's Washington, D.C. correspondent, talking to us there from Tampa, Florida, with Hurricane Isaac approaching there. So stay dry if you can, Sasha. You're listening to Midori House.
In the latest edition of The Entrepreneurs, we'll be looking at the market for Baltic bicycles in the UK. We'll be meeting one of the pioneers of Hong Kong independent retail, and we'll be finding out what high-tech startups can learn from century-old corporations.
We've got very, very strong partners in ABB and our manufacturing partners, so we'll be using that to get our global footprint, our foundation in place over the next 12 to 18 months to scale beyond that.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
No food, no battle. Monocle Films attends Kitchen Boot Camp to witness operational excellence in the field of the culinary arts.
We really try to provide to the last moment fresh food to our troopers. While other armies, they start quickly to eat out of tins and they just are distributing survival packages or bags where you add some hot water. We really try to serve good, healthy food based on fresh products, even on the front line.
You can watch this film and many more from affairs to business, culture to design in the programs menu on monocle.com.
It's 16 minutes past the hour here in Midori House. Now, despite the heavily taxed consumer goods, high income taxes for personals, and as well as the long, dark winter weather, Sweden, Norway, Finland and Denmark comprise the Nordic countries considered some of the best places in the world in which to live. And not only do people from those Nordic countries have great way of life when they're there, they're often healthier and, crucially, carry that success into whichever country they choose to lay their hat. Their welfare state welfare system is often referred to as an ideal for many other countries too. However, Sweden's wealth did not come through a welfare state system, argues Nima Sandaji, author who has written a report on the surprising ingredients of Swedish success, free markets and social cohesion. It's called for the Institute of Economic Affairs. And Nima joins us on the line, as well as Mark Littlewood, who's Director General of the IEA. Hello, Mark. Hello, Nima.
Good evening. Hi.
Good evening. Yes. And just tell us, what made you curious, Nima, about this topic?
Well, I live in Sweden. I work a lot with public policy issues in Sweden. And for me, it's been very interesting that foreign people who look at the Swedish system fail to take into account Swedish history. They just look at the simple correlation. Sweden has low poverty. Sweden has high taxes. Sweden has relatively high living standards. And therefore, they assume that Sweden has a social democratic system which allows good growth and poverty reduction. What they don't realize is that the poverty reduction in Sweden, the good social outcomes, existed during a period before the high tax regime. And that when Sweden went from low taxes to high taxes, we really got a number of problems with economic growth, with reduced entrepreneurship, and also actually in some sense with more social problems as a large percentage of the government, including my family when I was growing up, has been living off welfare rather than work.
So in a way, your report is concluding that it was nothing to do with the high taxes that makes a better society.
So it's more complicated. What my report really says is that Sweden, if you look at the beginning of the 20th century, had a system with a small welfare government, low taxes, around 20% of GDP, even lower at that time than the United States. But Swedes, since they had so good working ethics, since they have so good institutions, since they're so entrepreneurial, they managed to achieve not only fantastic economic growth, but also reduced income inequality through workfare. Then a shift happened towards high taxes. And of course, you could say there have been benefits, there have been also problems. But definitely what makes Sweden and other Nordic countries unique has much to do with their culture, not with the social democratic policies.
That's an interesting point, isn't it, Mark? Mark Littlewood, Director General of the Institute of Economic Affairs, also on the line, that actually it's the way of life, not necessarily the economic model under which Swedes and other people from the Nordic countries live in.
I think that's right, and I think that's why this paper is so important, and we at the Institute of Economic Affairs have been delighted to publish it, because as Nima quite rightly points out, there has been something of a myth that we sort of look at what is presumed to be Swedish policy of high taxes and high spending, associate that with Sweden basically having, you know, been and still being a very good country to live in, and QED, high taxes and high spending, must be the answer. Hmm. When, in fact, I'd say, if anything, that Sweden's a great country to live in despite that, and that's what the historical record shows. And intriguingly, pointed out in the report, is if you look at, say, Swedes or people of Swedish ancestry in the United States of America, they perform very well economically. The United States of America, not usually considered to be a sort of social democratic, high-tax, high-welfare model, yet nevertheless, those of Swedish extraction in America typically earn about $10,000 a year more than their standard American counterparts, and maybe $20,000 a year more than some people back in Sweden. So it does seem to be something, if you like, about being Swedish, rather than so much about the public policies, particularly the welfareist policies that Sweden has enacted. And certainly, if you look over the last 15 years or so, the trajectory of Sweden has been starting to move away from high tax, high spend. I mean, they've peaked on high tax, high spend. They're beginning to get that down, beginning to get their public finances under control, and are actually introducing quite a lot of schemes which would be considered very free market liberal schemes elsewhere. For example, they have for-profit schools in Sweden. That's considered to be a sort of toxic matter in the UK, that you could ever run a school for profit. They're beginning to introduce vouchers for the provision of other public services. So there's actually quite a lot of fairly radical free market liberal thinking in other parts of Swedish public policy that sometimes I think the public debate, certainly in the UK and other European countries, is somewhat blind to.
And Nima, what's your explanation as to Mark's point earlier, why Swedes who settle in other countries, say, for example, the USA, do so much better than perhaps other immigrants?
So historically, the Scandinavians, probably due to a very cold climate, developed a very unique working ethics. They developed very high levels of trusting strangers. And so their societies worked very, very well. And once they got the ingredients of free markets, they became rich. And then they developed a welfare state. And if you look at the Swedes in America, they are more than 50% richer than the Swedes in Sweden. They have the exact same poverty level. And also, one thing you can see, there's a research article where they compare the levels of trust amongst Americans. How much do you trust a stranger? And the group which has the highest level of trust are the ancestors, are those whose ancestors were from Scandinavian countries. So the Swedish culture, the Scandinavian culture makes for success. And I can give you two very good examples of this. If you just look at the recent development in Europe. When the financial crisis came, part of the reason I would say is that you used to have large welfare systems in Northern Europe, but then Southern European countries implemented large welfare policies, and they have traditionally weaker social norms, perhaps because they're not Protestant, perhaps because they have a warm, nice climate, and then you don't get strong working ethics. But you see, they haven't managed their welfare systems because they don't have the strong norms. And another example is, if you look at the financial crisis, the part of Europe that was most strongly affected was actually the Baltic countries. They were really hardly damaged by the crisis, but they haven't been behaving like Greece or Spain. The Baltic countries just saved money, they reduced public spending, and they just grew out of the crisis. You don't hear them complaining that all the rest of Europe should save them, they're growing well, etc. Why? Because they also have this strong Nordic working ethics. And probably, I would definitely argue that today, if you look at Scandinavian countries, the Nordic countries, those which have had most welfare policies have today the weakest norms. Those who have the most free market-oriented policies still have the very, very strong traditional norms. This is why the Baltic countries have their traditional working ethics that have to some degree disappeared in Sweden, and why Norway, which is probably one of the most socialist countries because of the oil wealth, have really, really weak working ethics, even compared to Sweden now.
Mm.
So I would say that the traditional working ethics has been changed by the welfare policies.
I mean, Mark, it's interesting, isn't it? The work ethics that Nima's talking about, the benefits, he says, perhaps the people live in a cold climate, and the social cohesion also. But that requires a certain amount of buy-in from the people themselves. Do you see that the Swedish model, if you want to call it, transferable to other countries as a whole?
Well, I think the cultural part of it isn't very transferable. I mean, you couldn't, for example, if you were looking for a model to improve Italy or Spain, suddenly decide that you wanted to import lock, stock and barrel everything that had happened in Sweden over the past 100 years. Culture is rather less flexible and importable than that. And my worry would be, and again, this is pointed out in Nima's report, that some of those substantial benefits of the Nordic or the Swedish systems have actually been undermined by a big welfare state. If you were to look back at the sort of early 80s and you ask Swedish people whether they thought it was ever justified to claim welfare benefits to which you were not entitled, a full 82% said they thought it was never justified. By about the turn of the century, when you've broadly had a very generous welfare system, a very high tax system in place, suddenly it's only 55% of Swedes who say it's never justified to claim benefits to which you're not entitled. So my fear, if you like, for Sweden, although I think they've now in recent years got themselves on the right track, a liberalising, deregulating track, is it does show that actually very substantial welfare benefits can over time begin to erode that culture of trust. If you like, the public sector kind of crowds out individuals building good, trusting, working relationships with each other. So it seems to me that the picture is much more complicated than some people suggest. It is not possible just to import all of the good things from Sweden and ignore all of the bad things, but very probably the Swedish experience has been a good one and continues to be a good one, despite their substantial experimentation with social democracy and high welfare, rather than because of it.
Mm, okay, well, we'll have to go there and experience it, the good times for ourselves. But thank you both for joining us. That's Nima Sanandaji, the author, and Mark Littlewood, Director General of the Institute of Economic Affairs. It's 19:28 in Stockholm, 18:28 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. We're going to stay on the topic of Nordic countries now. This is Swedish electronic music duo from Gävle, Sound of Arrows with Wonders. Sound of Arrows there and Wonders. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be finding out what wonders the Venice Architectural Biennale has in store and how Brazil's most voted for politician in 2010 was a clown called Tiririca. That's all after the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thanks very much. Around 2,000 workers, some carrying sticks and whips, have gathered today in South Africa to protest near a hill where police shot dead striking platinum miners early this month. 44 people were killed on the 16th of August in union violence around Maracana. Staying with mining news, and politicians have drowned out the Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh today as he sought to defend his government's role in an affair dubbed Coalgate, which is an acronym for a report published on the 17th of August that questioned the government's practice of awarding coal mining concessions to companies without competitive bidding, potentially costing the Treasury billions of dollars in lost revenues. As Tropical Storm Isaac churns over the Gulf of Mexico, delaying the start of the Republican National Convention by a day, workers are making finishing touches to the convention floor. Republican lawmakers in Tampa remain confident that their convention will be successful. Activists from the international environment group Greenpeace have today chained themselves to a ship near Russia's Gazprom oil rig in the Arctic. The activists, including the executive director, chained their motorboat to the ship's anchor. And firefighters, soldiers and volunteers are battling to contain flames as a heatwave has broken temperature records today and set off wildfires around Kosovo. Worst affected is the Dragash region in southern Kosovo, where flames have gutted over 500 hectares of pine trees, and in certain places flames of 8 metres high have been witnessed near the border with Albania. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Now, it might be a quiet day in London, with most of the city squeezing in another day of summer with a day off thanks to a public holiday today, but the first floor here at Midori House is still buzzing, and Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck and our resident Brasileiro Fernando Augusto Pacheco have joined us in the studio to discuss all things Brazilian politics. And Andrew, some very disruptive public sector strikes going on in that country at the moment.
A day of strikes which are hitting the airports. And that's kind of an election issue as well for these cities, because what's happening is in the run-up to the World Cup and in the run-up to the Olympics being staged, there's kind of bid to kind of turn these airports around. In the minute they're all state-run, and there's a general feeling that they need to be modernised, certainly. If anyone has gone through any of those airports, they are pretty terrible airports and not great experiences. And there's a real sense that the infrastructure needs to be changed ahead of those games. So they are election issues as well.
Well, there are, as you say, big elections coming up. They're mayoral elections. The first round starts the first week of October, going through the second round in the last week of October. But we're going to be talking about some of the interesting candidates that we see for some of the mayoral and the governmental positions in Brazil in a moment. But just picking up from what you're saying, that it's interesting for Dilma Rousseff, isn't it, the president? She's not. She was elected 2 years ago. She doesn't stand for election for another 2 years yet. But, you know, she's supposedly standing up for these people. It's a workers' party that is in power, and yet they're the ones on the streets causing all this disruption.
Yes, and again, with she's certainly involved heavily in these election campaigns. She's supposedly behind a slightly peculiar deal that's been done, actually, against her former rival in Sao Paulo, where José Serra is standing. This is the guy who stood against her in the elections for president and lost. He's now standing to be mayor of Sao Paulo. But the feeling is that there's a bit of a backroom deal being done by Dilma Rousseff to keep him out of power. And she's done a deal with this guy called Paulo Maluf, who has a pretty tough reputation, and also he's wanted in the US on certain charges of embezzlement. So it's going to be an interesting election, I think.
Well, interesting, as we say, Fernando, because of the people who are standing. Just give us some kind of background as to some of the candidates, serious and otherwise, that are standing. First of all, we'll look at the Rio mayor, where Eduardo Paes seems to be on course for victory there.
Yeah, I mean, actually, Paes is a very popular mayor, actually. And I think because he was very involved with the Olympics, the bid for Rio to win the Olympics. So I think he's definitely going to win the first round, because the second candidate is Marcelo Freixo. He's from a far left party. He's doing quite well, like 13-14%, but he doesn't stand a chance, I believe. I think Paes is an easy win.
And it's interesting because we met him when he came to London. He came in to meet me and Tyler Brulé, editor-in-chief, for talking about, you know, what was going to happen in the Olympics there. And obviously he came to a city, London, where actually what happened just before we got the, you know, we'd won the Olympics, but before they happened, the mayor who had won them, Ken Livingstone, was turfed out. And it was interesting talking to some of the people around him. You know, there was not concern, but I think they were definitely not kind of thinking, actually, he's so far ahead in the polls, we can ease up now. They were very well aware that you could win the Olympics for your city and then be turfed out.
No, absolutely, I agree. But yeah. Especially, I mean, he it must be a shame if he's not the mayor the next time, because he was clearly involved with the bid. But yeah, I mean, you never know, because the electorate, the TV campaign just started last week. So maybe Andrew's right. Everything can change in the next few weeks.
Okay, we'll see what happens with Paes. Moving to Sao Paulo, and talking of TV, a former TV presenter, Celso Russomanno, what's he like? He's going for the mayoral post there.
Exactly. It's quite. I was a bit surprised that he's ahead on the polls. He's the presenter of a show, like a very popular show. It's like a police show. I mean, he talks about crimes and everything. He's a bit of a populist, but all the analysts, they are saying that actually he's not going to stay ahead, because I think he's only got 2 minutes on the TV campaign. And of course, José Serra and Fernando Haddad. Because they belong to the major parties, they're going to be held like 10 minutes each. So I believe he's not going to win. But I'm quite surprised that he's ahead in Sao Paulo.
And tell us about some of the less conventional and potentially less serious candidates that Brazilian politics tends to throw up now and again.
We have many of them, I have to say. And I mean, it's crazy. I mean, probably you know this already. In 2010, our most voted MP, he's a clown. I mean, he is a clown.
He's like a. he's a real clown.
He's a real clown. And I think he was dressed as a clown in his first days in the Congress. Okay. But he's stopped. He's not dressing as a clown
anymore. Actually, I think, Fernando, that we've lined up a bit of a clip for you to hear. This is some of the kind of the colourful campaigning that's been going on. Caro amigo eleitor, é a terceira vez que estou pedindo o seu voto. Amigo, é bom imaginar. Você é o votar me olhando na foto. Eu sou Alírio Graça, 45121. Acredite, é hora de vencer. Esta força vem de dentro de você.
Well, I'm not sure whether that sounds like a normal afternoon on a little avenida somewhere, but tell us what was going on there.
Well, the last one, she was singing, "It is time to win. It comes deep inside your heart." And the thing is, she might win.
And who was that then? Who was the first person we heard?
Oh, the first person, he's like, actually, he was going for an MP in the northeast of Brazil, and he was saying like, "My name is Ailton and my number is that, so vote for me." He was quite direct.
But that's not the only. I mean, you spoke about the clown, a real clown. Then you have the interesting TV advertisements. But how much of it is of political protest? How much of it is local people from different towns or cities around Brazil saying enough of the politicians, whether they're liked or not, whether they're controversial or not, whether they're perceived as actually effective or not? You know, we're the real guys. Put us into power, and we'll do something for you.
Well, I mean. Actually, those funny candidates, I mean, a lot of people, they make fun of them. But actually, some people vote for them in some sort of protest vote. Mm. And including the middle class in Sao Paulo, in Rio, they say, oh, you know what, I don't trust the politicians, so I'm going to vote for the clown, you know. Mm. But the thing is, they end up being Congress, you know. So I'm not sure if that's effective, you know.
What I love also about this election, there's 138 million people who are voting in these mayoral elections. You just think of the kind of organisation, the scale of voting in Brazil. It's an amazing achievement. When you're at home in Sao Paulo, when you see these elections going on, do people vote in, as they do in Europe, in schools and things, in libraries? What is the voting process like on the day?
They do, and actually there's something very interesting. Actually, we vote electronically, and I think we're one of the few countries, it's 100%. We don't vote like in paper anymore, and it's very modern. So you get the results on the day, like the election, probably they close everything at 7, and at midnight we have basically all the results.
And for mayoral elections, would they be covered all by all the regional big TV stations? They'd be there watching the results as they come in.
They will, yeah.
Okay, we'll see what happens. Obviously, a sense of humour is pretty much required in political campaigning, especially when you have candidates called Barata Obama, the lollipop of love, which I'll let you explain, and Elvis Now Moreu. Elvis didn't die.
Apparently. Oh, God, yeah. And it can go worse and worse.
He's an impersonator, or he's just making a point?
I don't know. I don't know personally. Elvis didn't die, but I just think it's a pretty effective way.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll cover all of those candidates and what happens in the coming weeks and months. Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Andrew Tuck, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House.
Aus London, das ist Monaco 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24 horas.
London, então, eu ganho Monaco 24 ainda.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monaco 24.
London, cara, Monaco 24.
De Londres, este é Monaco 24.
And this is Monocle 24, and we'll be back in a moment with what'll be turning heads at the Architecture Biennale in Venice this week.
On the latest edition of the menu, Monocle 24's weekly food and drink show, we discover how the Russians take their coffee, we speak to a man who knows his craft beers, try to find out where hummus was invented, and then head to a restaurant on a Chicago rooftop that doubles up as a farm.
It is possible to do both, to be in an urban environment, but have, you know, a green roof. Actually use that in your food.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
:22 in Moscow, 18:42 here in London, and 13:42 in New York City. Now the hotels, restaurants and water taxis of Venice are preparing to welcome a mass of men and women, predominantly in white shirts, to the lagoon as the world of architecture comes to town for the 13th International Architecture Exhibition, which starts on Wednesday. This year's Biennale is directed by British architect David Chipperfield and is titled Common Ground. For more on this, a little earlier, our design editor Hugo MacDonald spoke to Tyler Brulé and started by checking, after we saw photos this weekend showing Venice being engulfed by enormous storm clouds, that Hugo had in fact landed safely before the downpours occurred.
Yeah, thank goodness, because as you say, the clouds just came in from nowhere in the space for about 20 minutes, and it really was properly apocalyptic and quite scary because suddenly the wind whipped up and all the boats on the lagoon started going crazy. And there was a mixture of everybody taking pictures with their phones and iPads on the bridges of this incredible cloud formation, and then suddenly realising that things were probably going to get a little bit dramatic and dashing indoors for a bit of safety. But that all passed, and it was the most beautiful sunset, and it's now blistering sunshine.
Very nice. And before we go on to the topic of all things architectural and aesthetically pleasing, I must ask this question. I think I know the answer, though. There is no elegant way of taking a picture with an iPad, is there? It's like holding up a big coat. It's like holding up an enormous placemat.
But the picture that I sent you was just of the clouds. I also took a picture of two people taking a picture on their iPads, and I wondered whether to send that one to you because I thought maybe you would enjoy it.
very
ridiculous.
Dreadful stuff. At least we can assure listeners that you will not be documenting anything on your iPad. I guess headlines first. Was it yesterday or was today the kickoff?
Today is the kickoff. Today is the opening press day of, it's the 13th Venice Architecture Biennale. And David Chipperfield, a much lauded British architect, is the director this year. And he's chosen the theme of Common Ground, which is what all the architects who he invites to take over a space in the Arsenale, they sort of have to respond to in some way. And also all the pavilions in the Giardini, which each of the countries who participate, they can choose whether to respond to it or not as well.
That's what I was going to say. It must be rather complicated because, as you said, in the Giardini, there are all of these existing pavilions, and of course these nations participate every other year, so those are obviously appointed at a national level. I mean, do you have any sense yet how many have responded to indulge his brief?
Most people have. I think he's been quite clever in choosing an almost absurdly open brief. Common Ground can pretty much be interpreted any way you like, and that's the interesting thing. I've only seen maybe a quarter of all that there is to see at the moment, but everybody seems to have taken it up and is trying to sort of respond in quite different ways. It's not just a lot of people showing public spaces in their cities, which you worry it might turn into.
So far, having only covered a quarter of the ground, and I guess two questions. I mean, you've only covered a quarter of the ground. What stands out? But then how much actually happens in and around the Giardini versus how much does the rest of Venice also embrace the Biennale as well?
Well, this is one of the big things that's changed, I think, this year, is it's usually all pretty self-contained in the Giardini and the pavilion there, or in the Arsenale, which is the giant old shipyards, about a 10-minute walk from the gardens. This year, I think possibly because of the theme of Common Ground, there's been a real effort to push it out into Venice. And so Studio Vogt, which is a wonderful Swiss architecture practice, have actually taken over all the kiosks in the city and are using that to hand out flyers with various sort of provocative slogans to engage not just the architecture industry, but people who want to stop off and buy some water and things, with questions to make them think about public space and about how architecture isn't just for architects, but it affects everybody. So that's one simple example of the way in which things have spilled over this year. And it makes the Biennale much less of a sort of architectural group hug, which can be a little bit claustrophobic and stifling, and something a little bit more engaging and interesting for everybody who might be in Venice.
Well, particularly if you're in the embrace of some big, meaty architect's biceps, for sure, I would imagine.
There's quite a few of those going around. There's a lot of skin on, so.
Tell me, though, with... looking at sort of the schedule and the importance of this for Venice, because this always comes as a bit of a you know, 1-2 punch. So you either have the architecture, the Art Biennale, and then of course you have the film festival. You know, it's almost the tone setter, isn't it, to mark the start of the cultural season across Europe. And I'm wondering, do you feel that brand Italia has even put a bit more effort into things this year? I'm not sure if there's any sense of what's on the horizon, of course, with the film festival. But do you think there's this real understanding that, you know, maybe they, you know, just given the state of the economy and really, you know, the role of Italy, you know, not just within the EU, but certainly with all eyes on where things might end up with the euro, that there's just a little bit more, you know, effort this year?
Definitely. And actually, it's poignant that... a very good ending to this story, because Paolo Baratta, who's the chairman of the Venice Architecture Biennale, was quite unceremoniously sacked by Berlusconi just before he himself got the shove. And everybody was up in arms. This was in, I think, end of October last year, because people thought, you know, what on earth does that turn the Architecture Biennale into? Is it just going to be another mouthpiece for Berlusconi, who's going to shove one of his cronies in Baratta's place? But then after Berlusconi was replaced by Monti, Baratta was very quickly reinstated. And that's given this Biennale a sense of sort of relief that actually things are slightly back on track. Going back to Brand Italy, it's quite interesting, and I don't know if it's just coincidence, but 2 years ago for the Biennale, most of Venice was under hoardings, and not just hoardings for restoration, but hoardings that had been taken over by a series of maybe quite predictable sponsors. So you had the Bridge of Sighs behind Coca-Cola, you had most of St. Mark's Square behind a lot of watch companies. And all of that is done, all of that's taken off now, and actually the restoration that had been going on behind those hoardings has left Venice looking spectacular, and not in an artificial way. It's sort of been a real exercise in trying to polish Venice up a little bit for, as you say, the sort of ongoing cultural seasons that take place each year here.
And just before we go, Hugo, I know you'll be reporting in throughout the week, and we don't want to, of course, blow the cover on any of the bigger features that you're doing. But what are you looking forward to the most? I mean, before you left yesterday, we were talking about Angola or making their premiere. Is there anything else that you really want to see, or that certainly people are buzzing about?
Yes, definitely. And actually, it's a sort of small name architect who I'd never heard of, but are doing fantastically interesting things. You mentioned Angola showing there for the first time. Kosovo is also showing for the first time, as is Q8. And both of them have put on really thought-provoking, interesting, very sort of quiet exhibitions that there's nothing sensational about them, which is in stark contrast to, say, the room before Kosovo. Hadid has just done a big monograph of her work, and it serves to highlight the disparity between, at the one end, you have these giants of the architecture industry who everybody's a little bit bored of, I think. I'm not just speaking for myself there. And then you go into the Kosovan Pavilion next door and you see something that is genuinely interesting and genuinely problem-solving. And that's really what the Biennale should be about, I think.
And that was Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, in Venice, talking to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, a little earlier today on the Architecture Biennale, which starts this Wednesday. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Past the hour. Now, 16 Amish men and women are set to go on trial in Cleveland today, were charged with hate crimes. They're accused of settling scores by attacking and then cutting the hair and beards of their enemy Amish people. Other charges include conspiracy, tampering with evidence, and obstruction of justice in what prosecutors say were crimes motivated by religious differences within the Amish community. While splits within that community are fairly common, physical attacks involving hair and beard cutting are considered deeply offensive in Amish culture. Well, we're now joined on the line by John Baker, journalist at The Times Reporter in New Philadelphia. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you very much for joining us. Now, tell us, has this trial actually come towards its first day today, Monday? It was scheduled for it. Did it actually go ahead?
Yes, as far as I know, it's already commenced.
And just outline some of the background about how these two factions came to eventually these rather sort of disturbing, what they're calling hate crimes.
What happened, apparently it was a differences over religious beliefs, and they decided to cut the hair of some of the Amish women and cut the beards of the Amish men. That's considered deeply offensive in their culture.
And do we know what the arguments and the actual, you know, the trouble was about between the two groups?
I'm not aware of that, but there tends to be a lot of different differences over various beliefs in the Amish church. There's dozens of different factions involved.
Now, tell us about the area, the locality that we're talking about. Where are you based? I believe you're based in New Philadelphia. And yes. Where are the settlements?
We're about 10 miles east of Holmes County, which is the home to the largest Amish community in the United States. There's approximately 30,000 Amish living there, and they're a very industrious people. As a matter of fact, Holmes County has one of the lowest unemployment rates in Ohio because the people there, they either work on the farms, or if they don't work in the farms, they are skilled carpenters or woodworkers, or they work in various factories. And we have quite a bit of factories operating in that area, small handicraft type shops.
Indeed, and tell us how do this group of Amish fit in with the local non-Amish community?
They live in a different area from the main Holmes County community. Their settlement is probably about 30 or 40 miles to the east of New Philadelphia, and they're a breakaway group, and I think they just practice farming mostly.
And the group that are going to trial and for these attacks on them, therefore they're from a different community altogether, somewhat further away?
Yes. What's going on here is the Amish community in Holmes County is growing because they tend to have large families of 7 to 8 children, and in general most of the children tend to stay in the Amish faith, and they run into the problem where they're running out of farmland for their farms, and so they're creating new colonies all across our part of Ohio, moving into different areas where land is much cheaper.
I see. So that's what the root of a lot of this is.
Yes, it's just expansion. There's competition for land and also differences in religious beliefs that lead to these conflicts.
Right. Okay. Just explain, if you can, how a lot of people see the Amish culture in your part of the world. Obviously, some people would have seen the movie Witness. That's as much as some people would have got exposed to the Amish community. Does it stand to any kind of reality?
I would guess. I'm not that familiar with the Amish themselves, but we know a lot about the community, and generally we have a very positive view because the Holmes County Amish community, and there is a major tourist attraction. It attracts upwards of 4 million visitors a year, and it brings a lot of needed revenue into our area through tourists.
Well, that's interesting that you say it's a tourist attraction, because there are some restrictions on you. You're not allowed to take a lot of photos of the Amish. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, you cannot take their photos. I mean, you can take them from behind, but you cannot actually take a picture from them from their front. We always try to remember that when we're doing stories over there for our newspaper.
Indeed so, and that must have made coverage of this trial rather problematic.
I think in the case of these men, they have actually taken their photographs. I think they've even had booking photos from the police.
So right. They've
made exception in this case.
Yes. And tell us further about, you say it's a tourist attraction, there are shops and items that they make for sale. How important is that to their community, as well as the farming element that you spoke about?
Well, it's a very large part of the economy in that area. Some of the Amish families have done quite well. Plus, we have lots of hotels and restaurants. People come there; they like to sample Amish style food, or they can visit Amish farms and ride in a buggy and see what Amish life is like. So it's more than just shopping. There's a whole array of activities for visitors.
And finally, how are you expecting this trial to progress? Because as we've been saying, you know, the cutting of beards, as some refer to it, as a hate crime, but it's so important in the Amish community.
Yes, it is. My guess is that they could likely be found guilty. The evidence seems to point in that direction.
Okay, well, we'll follow the story. But thank you very much for joining us there, John. That's John Baker, reporter from The Times Reporter in New Philadelphia. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks very much for our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who we heard from earlier with Andrew Tuck, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is this week's brand new episode of The Culture Show. And today we speak to a Spanish Paralympic cyclist, and Katie Bilboa reports on a performance of Stockhausen's seven-day opera in Birmingham, complete with live helicopters. In 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Dom Reynolds and Andrew Muller are here with the Monocle Daily, and I'll be back with Midori House same time tomorrow. But for now, thanks for listening and goodbye.